little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
My name is Bob Frelick. Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And the best thing, really, Julia, about doing this back porch show is that we've been together remotely and we get to be in person with each other.
Yes, and the cat. The cat's a bonus.
And the cat. The cat is our personal assistant for the evening. So we got lots to talk about here on Thinking Clearly on this episode. Let's just briefly tell folks how they can get in touch with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like I like to say, Bob and I are real people, and you can talk to us. We also have a Facebook page, Thinking Clearly, where we diligently put up promos and notes from the episode, and especially, you know, for this show, there will be added information. And then also we are podcasting. You can just open up your podcast app and search for Thinking Clearly, or visit the website to get the entire archive if you don't use a podcast app. That's thinkingclearly.libsyn.com.
Well, let's get started. The way I would frame this topic is vetting information. Using critical thinking skills in a complex, technical, culturally shifting world. And this is going to be part one of a three-part series that we're calling the series Seeking the Truth of the Matter. Before I go on with this, let me tell you about this word vetting. I've looked for all kinds of words to use, but vetting is such a wonderful word for doing this. But it's not the most commonly used word. So
it's what you do when you're being a veterinarian, right?
No, that's why I'm correcting what people think, because that's how people use that word. But to vet something means to do a careful and critical examination of something. And that's one of the things that we're talking about tonight. And to evaluate possible approval, this thing that we're vetting for possible approval or acceptance. So it's the perfect word. I'm going to use it all through whenever I talk about what we're discussing tonight, which is seeking the truth of the matter. So anyway, we're going to start by talking about how critical thinking skills can help us navigate through the present state, deplorable state, I might add, of our information environment, which is embedded, and this is becoming ever more clear to me, in a complex and culturally shifting social environment. Then we're going to discuss the importance of forming critical thinking habits, not just a few times, but actually making that a habit. And then we're going to outline a step-by-step method for vetting information in order to help us tentatively decide the truth value of that information and to help us decide what to do with that information. So that's what we're about tonight. And so we're going to start out talking a little bit about the information environment, how it's complex and technical. It's complex because a lot of the information is very specialized and requires a lot of background information. I'm finding when I'm looking at things that I get over my social media or over the internet somewhere, I have to get on and do some searches for background knowledge about that issue. And we just live in this kind of a complex society where there's so much information that we've gotten in the last 200 years about everything, that complexity and the abundance is just tremendous. According to, I looked this up, Social Media Today, over 2.5 quintillion, that's a billion bytes of data are created every single day. That's a lot of information.
Yeah, well, information is definitely technical. There's a lot of different ways that we're exposed to information, especially these days. You know, some more antiquated forms of transmitting information that some of us might remember is newspapers, phone, radio, TV, I would even add commercials, magazines, and of course the push and pull of the internet, which is probably where a lot of us get our information, especially these days with shelter in place. The pull is like when you do searches on the internet, you go looking for something, you pull it towards you. The push is what the internet is pushing towards you. Of course, that comes in the form of advertising, but also personalized information to cater to what they think is your preference.
And I remember when the push technology really started, you know, we had an internet before we had information pushed to us in news feeds and our Facebook feeds and things like that. I was always a little wary of the push. The people who provide that information have a lot more control over what they push towards us than what we pull out of the internet. So I use the internet almost exclusively for pulling information from, and very little for looking at stuff that's pushed at me. And I know there still is some control in the pull, right?
I would say it's reciprocal. The very thing that you're pulling from the internet then serves to push you what it thinks you want. So I'll use like Google search as an example. For instance, let's say you had a strong interest in snakes and you do a lot of Google searches for things about herpetology and snakes. Well, in the future, you might go searching the state of Virginia, and the first thing that it's going to show you is snakes in Virginia. So it's a reciprocal push and pull, especially these days.
Right. But you can use DuckDuckGo, right?
Yeah, that is one example.
That's a search engine that doesn't control so much what we see according to our profile that they've developed on us.
But they are the exception.
Yeah.
There's a reason they exist, and it's because they are an exception.
Yeah. But everybody ought to have at least the option of DuckDuckGo when they want to use it on their browser. The other thing that's associated with this is that our information technology is really highly networked. It allows us to communicate and form numerous groups virtually anywhere in the world. So, I mean, that's especially prevalent in Facebook, but there's a lot of other ways that that comes up in the internet. So we can form groups anywhere that we want to based on our beliefs, things that we want to accomplish in the world or things that we want to learn about.
Well, except China, but go on.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so what about social networks? How does that come into this?
Yeah, well, social networks are definitely a newer aspect of the internet. The social networks, you know, part of the way that network is built is sometimes around specializations, basically specialized groups. So, for instance, Reddit, affectionately known as the front page of the internet or a longstanding forum, is divided into, you know, a lot of categories and subreddit communities. So again, if you had an interest in snakes, I bet you could go on Reddit and find a forum dedicated to snakes, a forum dedicated to poisonous snakes, a forum dedicated to snakes in Virginia. So it's definitely allows for a lot more kind of specialized interest with folks of similar interest.
I looked up Reddit, and I don't use Reddit a lot. In fact, not very often at all, except to see what kinds of groups are on there. But I looked them up on Wikipedia, and there's 138,000 different active subreddits and growing all the time. And they're pretty amazing diversity. Well, the thing is that the ability to associate with groups has its ups and it has its downs. And one of the downs is that it's caused, in addition to other things, an increasingly divided, polarized kind of situation between groups. And we talked about this before on our show, the polarity and the polarization that's happening in groups. And the thing is that these groups, actually, when they become polarized and separated from each other in regard to their worldviews, beliefs, or acceptable behavioral norms, what tends to happen is that people start to coalesce around certain ideas, and they talk about these ideas in their group, and then they begin to differentiate us versus them, and it increases the polarization. And then, as we've talked about before in terms of polarization, it eventually gets so polarized, so apart, that the them becomes the other, and the other isn't morally incapable of understanding anything that's right with the world, is probably ignorant and maybe even subhuman. So, you know, we really begin to disparage those other groups. And that's a lot of what's happening worldwide. It's happening, and we see it very prevalently in this country, but it's happening all over the world.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And we tend to reinforce our identity with these groups, you know, and by publicly reinstating our group's beliefs and behavior. And, you know, it's reiterating, you know, what team we belong in a way, kind of flying our flag, if you will. And like you said, you know, that can also involve making fun of and criticizing the beliefs of others who are not in the group.
Yeah. And we've talked about this. We have another episode. You can go to our archives, our podcast archives, and look for that one. And we talked about this. It's called Identity Protective Cognition. That's such a descriptive name. We protect our identity, and we use a type of cognition that allows us to protect that identity in these groups that we affiliate and associate with. And that was episode 35. We had a guest professor, John Gasto from Penn State University, talking about that. And that, like Julia said, is becomes a motivation to signal to others that we're members in good standing. You know, we do that. We do it here on KMUD. You know, I call it preaching to the choir. You know, and we begin then to the problem with that. There's nothing wrong with affiliating and showing that we are associated with other folks. I mean, that's part of being a human being. Identifying with groups and feeling some closeness with that group that think like us and or believe the same ways or behave like us. But the problem is that it keeps our beliefs stagnant, because instead of examining our beliefs and questioning some of our beliefs, we want to be a member in good standing. We just parrot. I call it the company line. So that's one of the downsides of that. And we use our heuristics and our biases to do that. And we do have another show on heuristics and biases. We're not going to go over all that stuff. We're kind of reviewing some of the stuff that we've covered in a summary to lay the groundwork about the kind of information environment that we have and what we need to do about it.
Yeah, and to, you know, make matters even more difficult, our, as I mentioned earlier, incoming information streams tend to reflect what we're interested in. You know, like I said, if, you know, you're searching snakes, you know, frequently, then the internet, you know, is going to try and serve you things along that interest, reinforcing your interest in snakes. But who knew? Like, maybe you're really into frogs and you just never realized it, you know, and you got stuck in that filter bubble.
Tell us what a filter bubble is.
A filter bubble is, well, exactly like what I'm describing. When you're constantly searching for a particular kind of information, again, especially Google, will use that search history and try and give you information catered to that. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, if you're searching snakes a lot, and then you look up the state of Virginia, maybe you really wanted to look for turtles in Virginia. What you're going to see are pages and pages and pages of snakes in Virginia. And you'll never learn about your passion for frogs.
Yeah.
Because you never had the chance to learn about amphibians because you kept getting served snakes.
Yeah. So again, that tends to keep us stagnant and the status quo, right? These folks that are making money off of being able to predict our behavior so that they can actually sell us some things and make some money from those ads, they want to be able to keep us in a very predictable kind of zone. And so there's a tendency to feed us back information. That's how I view the filter bubble, is feed us back information that is going to keep us even more predictable and keep us even more able to decide how to appeal to us with their ads. And what that does is it filters out. That's why that term is so great. It filters out information so that we're not getting the diversity of information to really examine our beliefs, our thoughts, our ideas that we have. So it's problematic.
It's considered a perk. They're helping you find what you're looking for.
Well, that's the good side.
And the intent behind it originally, it's not also not just advertisements. It's just people who want you to find their website think that, you know, you search snakes a lot, so you're going to want to find their website about snakes.
Yeah. So how does that now correspond to we have echo chambers? How's that? How's a filter bubble different than an echo chamber?
That's a good question. An echo chamber is more of your own opinion reverberated, you know, so a lot of the times it's what I find like in Facebook groups, you know, people, you join a snake group because you love snakes and everyone else in the group loves snakes. And you're not going to have anybody who doesn't like snakes in that group challenging that idea. So that's kind of more of like an echo chamber where it's all sort of the same ideas and opinions. Whereas, right, the filter bubble is like a shelter. It's filtering what is given to you and what isn't given to you instead of what would just be like a printed page in the newspaper.
Yeah. And additionally, besides trying to keep us predictable, You know, the other thing that algorithms, because algorithm is just a, you know, like a computer program or
it's an equation,
a method, to track people. And they develop profiles for us and they can begin to see what we click on. And they therefore can feed us emotional laden content and move us over more towards those things that we really believe in. And that makes us even more predictable and able to click on things. And that's called clickbait, right? People who have websites that are targeted towards triggering people emotionally with certain issues and then amplifying that into grandiose headlines and that most people won't really read except for the headlines. And it gets them excited, upset, angry. It gets them into that emotional state of mind rather than actually thoughtfully thinking about something.
No one wants to click on a link they think is going to be boring.
I don't know. I love it when the headline is a reflection of just what the article is, and the article is what is reflected by the person who developed the information in the first place. I don't want to be entertained. I want good, solid information, especially in this day and age. But the entertainment value is certainly effective. So talking about this rapidly shifting cultural social system that we're in, you have any ideas about that and how that bears on what we're talking about tonight?
I'm still fascinated that you like clicking on boring links. You're exceptional like that, Bob.
I know. Well, this is the great thing about being where we can see each other, you know, we can laugh at each other, we can roll our eyes, you know, I love this. But thinking about polarization, I'm thinking about anger at the others and this kind of thing. And to me, a big part of this is that what do you expect when you have such rapidly dramatic cultural change? I thought we had a lot of cultural change in the 60s. Yeah, there was a lot of cultural change in the 60s. And I thought we're never going to live through that again. But I, you know, to me, it's becoming obvious that the amount of cultural change that's occurring now is in some ways even more dramatic and pressing. And it upsets the system. It upsets the equilibrium. So I think it's part of the factor that we're seeing in this information environment and this polarization that we're seeing is that there are many things that are changing culturally. Gender-neutral bathrooms. That upsets some people and overjoys other people.
It's not neutral. Yeah, and I think like we were saying, you know, a big difference today versus, you know, like the 60s, as you mentioned, is that it's easier to not be exposed to other opinions or diversity of opinions because you can kind of shelter yourself in these echo chambers and filter bubbles. Just a little side note, they're saying online dating has changed the way people pair together quite a bit because now when you're checking out a prospective date, you're asking, well, what do we have in common? Do we both like the same food? Do we listen to the same music? Whereas that may not have been as important or even as accessible before online dating.
Yeah. There was probably more just standard protocol before. And now there's that protocol is changing. That's just another example. I think there's many of those examples, but maybe we can even do an entire show on this sometime. But the amount of cultural change that's happening and how that fits into this whole thing that we're seeing in polarization, you know, what's happening between the various groups. So it's a perfect storm. This information environment and the changes that are occurring culturally have spawned a lot of books, a lot of blogs, a lot of social science studies. I see them all the time coming up, with a critical thinking book or a polarization in our social system. And so there's a lot of this, and it's really, especially since the election 2016, I think it has accelerated. But it highlights for me the importance of employing critical thinking as a means of, I like to call it, cognitive self-defense.
So what are some of the benefits of using critical thinking to examine our information stream and beliefs? I mean, that's why we do this, right?
What can you think of?
Well, definitely ownership. Yeah. There can be, you know, intrinsic reward from knowing that we have vetted the information and we've earned the beliefs that we have, that it's backed up by the footwork, as they say, and that we have the most accurate information and sound arguments that, you know, to if we choose to push back on the beliefs of others or even, well, heck, sometimes I challenge my own beliefs. And having... Again, having done that work and having the ownership over experiencing that journey to the conclusion and the belief that you're at is rewarding in and of itself, at least to me.
Yeah, and a lot of the research, especially in, well, even extends to sociology, cognitive science, neuroscience, and economics, is how to make better decisions. And the other big thing that's becoming a big thing is accurate forecasting, being able to learn how to be a more accurate forecaster than just using sort of our intuitive ideas about what's, you know, what might happen in the future. So making better decisions and forecasts, I think, are a couple additional reasons and motivations for critical thinking.
Yeah. And, you know, something I've been really kind of tickled by, because I'm that annoying person on Facebook who's like, did you read the article? Really? Did you?
Yeah.
Or, you know, did you notice that this is 3 years old? It's old news, you
right.
know? And I know I annoy the heck out of people.
Good for you.
But if more people got with it, yes. I wouldn't be that one person.
Yes.
We could do it together.
You're right.
So I will say I am very tickled when sometimes I'm on Facebook or something and I see other people saying, oh, that looks like that was published in 2017. Are you sure about that?
Yeah.
And, you know, if we did that enough collectively, and I would also add with good intent, with a certain amount of kindness and politeness that sometimes gets lost on the internet, we can really affect change in the whole information environment that we're in right now and can be problematic at times.
Yeah. And what's worse than it was talked about in 2017, so it's old news, is, and it was even shown to be fake news at that time. Yeah, that's always my fear, is to post something and it turns out to be fake news. There is so much fake news. And the thing about fake news is, I think it's ironic, because I usually don't say fake news, I say real fake news. Because fake news has become just another way of saying something I don't agree with.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Our president, current president, is very good at that. Something that he doesn't agree with is fake news. It's all fake news, whether he's read it or not. So don't use fake news that way. It's, you know, or if you do, say it's real fake news. You know, it's not that I just don't agree with this and call it fake news.
Or why it's fake news. I mean, that's the other thing. Explain why it's fake news. Is it fake news because it comes from a source you don't like? Is it fake news because it's literally made up? Is it fake news because it's satire? You know, it's... If yeah. you throw that around, get specific.
Yeah, there's been satire sites around for years, but usually they let you know they're satire sites. They're not masquerading as an authentic news site like is being done a lot. There are a lot of fake news sites out there. And
real fake news sites.
Real fake news sites. And those are another way of getting people upset, triggering them. So anyway, we've talked about the virtues for critical thinking. Now let's talk about creating critical thinking as a habit, because for most of us, and we've done shows on this, our first response is to almost everything we see is this automatic, kind of intuitive, which we have called system one, and other people have called system one cognition. It's a quick reaction. It's a, oh, I love that, or I hate that guy, or right on, or that's BS, you know, and that's as far as we go with it. With many things, we either discard it or we accept it. Wow, yeah, they think just like I do. And there's a lot of that. I love to look at my Facebook feeds and then check out that information to see if it's actually fake news or misinformation or disinformation. And I've gotten in the habit, like you, of actually, in a very nice way, because these are people who are my friends on Facebook.
He used air quotes, by the way. Radio air quotes.
Radio
his
air
friends.
Quotes. Yeah. In a very nice way, because it doesn't do any good to get angry about it. Give people the source information for why it's fake news, where I got that information, and a correction for the information. So this is all to the idea it takes work and focus to do critical thinking. It's easy to use that fast system one. It's harder to get yourself into a deliberative, analytic state of mind and spend some time really vetting the information. But that's what we're encouraging you to do, is to make that shift. And it's really important in this political climate to do. So to review, this is part one of a three-part series, and we're going to continue this episode now. We've laid the groundwork in terms of motivation to do critical thinking in this horribly polluted information environment that we're exposed to. Now what we're going to do is we're going to describe a kind of a quick and dirty process for vetting information. And then next month, we're going to take a step back because we're talking about what's true. Well, what does it mean? What is truth? What's the nature of truth? What is truth to you? I'm not asking you that we're going to take a whole show on this.
It's getting epistemological in here.
It's getting philosophic. And I mean, there's countless philosopher hours discussing this topic. But next month, we're going to have three people. We're going to have a guest. And we're going to each respond to some questions about the nature of truth. And we're going to have a civil dialogue among us. And then we're going to open the phone lines for listeners to define or describe truth as what they think it is, not what is specifically true. We don't want to get off in topics like that.
What is
truth? What does it mean to say something is true? And then in November, then we're going to come back to this method of vetting information that we're talking about. And Julie and I are, over the time, going to work on applying that method to a specific piece. And this is a 22-minute video that was sent to me on a Facebook Messenger group chat. And the video presentation is done by a woman introducing herself as Dr. Carrie Myers. And it's on YouTube, and it's titled Warning on 2020 COVID Vaccine. I don't know if you got a chance to look at that yet.
Yeah. And it's on YouTube, so it's got to be true.
Yeah. So Julie and I independently are going to work and use this process that we're going to talk about now for vetting that information on YouTube. And we encourage you to follow along with us. I'm going to post where you can find that on Facebook. So that's what we're up to. And we're up to about halfway through the show.
Yeah.
A little over halfway through the show. So let's start this off. And I want you to write these down. The first part, the logic of this first part of this kind of three-part method is to try to make that switch from your intuitive, quick system one thinking to the more deliberate thinking. And it does that by asking you to do some simple introspection, self-analysis. And the first part of that, there's three parts to it. The first part is motivation. So you're asking yourself, is this information important enough and or interesting enough for me to use my time and energy to examine using critical thinking skills? After all, if it's not interesting or important enough, you're not going to want to take the time. So you examine your motivation. We're asking you to write this down. You don't have to write a lot, just a sentence or two, and make that shift. So what's the second part?
Your intuition and biases. Asking yourself, what are my initial intuitions and biases going into this vetting process? And like you said, it's that knee-jerk reaction. Is it, oh, this guy, or oh, this guy, And to being cognizant of those is really important when starting the process.
Yeah. And again, it doesn't have to be much, but write them down. And then the third part is goals. What do you want to do with this information? Now, you may not know until you find out how valuable the information is and you've examined it, what you want to do. But I mean, do you want to use it to just find out if it's true or not because you're interested, you're curious? Or do you want to use it to push back on the person that sent the information, develop some of your own arguments and ideas and evidence to push back on that information? So the third thing is to just examine your goals. Again, it just has to be something easy to write as a starting point. All right, let's talk about now where we start on this vetting process. First thing we do is these three things that are introspective, that we've written down. And the second part, Julia, would you outline that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, you definitely want to start with evaluating your source, you know, taking a good hard look at what is the authenticity and reliability of the news or information source that you're getting it from. There, as you mentioned earlier, are numerous websites that, there are numerous websites that list known real fake news websites. For example, PolitiFact.com has a list, FactCheck.org has a list. And those are just the ones that have been, there's consensus that they are real fake news, as you would say. But there are more than enough out there on the internet, believe me.
So that's the starting point. And I have become such a stickler with this, even in conversations when someone says something that is a claim of some sort, and we're going to talk about what a claim is in a moment, I'll ask them, well, where'd that come from? Well, you know, what's the source for that? I'm surprised at how often people say, oh, it's internet or oh, Facebook, or, but they don't really know specifically where the source is. So what is the source? Evaluate the source. Where did you get this information from? That's the first part of this getting into the nuts and bolts of the vetting process here. And the second part is that source original or is it a repost?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people repost other information, and sometimes they give where they got that source from, but most often they don't. Sometimes it's a web page and they'll, you know, post the web page so you can go to that source. But was that the original source or was that a repost? So you want to track it back as much as you can to what is the original source of that information, mm-hmm. because that's critical.
My history teacher really drove that home for me because people like to write history books. And is one history book citing a previous history book citing a previous history book? Or are we actually going to read this Frederick Douglass's speech?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So that's what they would call primary source.
And you can usually find that primary source, even if they don't, whoever gave you the source doesn't give a citation, by Googling some keywords that is used in that information and try and track it down. I've usually been able to find that.
Oh, yeah. So another thing that we want to take into consideration is expertise. What expertise or credentials does the original source have for generating this information? If I'm a medical doctor, you know, am I an expert in snakes? I mean, maybe, but being a doctor doesn't have anything to do with that.
What are your credentials? Do you have educational credentials to go along with that? Or maybe you don't have any degrees in it, but you've spent hours and hours and hours actually reading original papers and source material and stuff. So you can be an expert without credentials, but most people that I've encountered on the internet that are disseminating information that doesn't seem to be accompanied by real evidence don't have those credentials. And you can find out what a person's credentials are. There's a lot of keyword searching that you can do on the internet to do that. And remember, we're going to post this whole vetting process and all the steps to it are on our Facebook page. So we'll see if we can get through the last part. So these are the last steps of this vetting process. Starting out with identifying the claims. That's so important. Just like identifying the source, tracking it back to the original source is very important. The next most important thing is to identify the claims in the information. And claims are simply statements about what is true or about what is good or bad or about what should be done or believed. Now, they're declarative statements. So in information, if it's stuff that you can highlight, you can go through and highlight the claims. It's very important to understand those claims because there's a lot of other language, you know, emotionally laden, name calling, all that extraneous kind of stuff that doesn't have anything to do with really critical thinking. You want to kind of filter those out and get it down to the nuts and bolts of identifying the claims. And then where would you go from there?
Yeah, well, we talked about one claim. you want to see if there is one claim that logically is supported by another claim. And that's a sign that, well, you have an argument. The author's making is making the argument, and the main claim is the conclusion, and the supporting claims are the premises. So looking for words like because, therefore, will kind of give you a hint that there's that conclusion. So let's see, an example here is vote for Dan because he's the only candidate who will cut taxes and create jobs.
That's a statement that somebody could have sent to you. There's a premise and a conclusion there, right? The premise is in this election, you should only vote for a candidate who will cut taxes and create jobs. I reworded it a little bit, you know, to put it into sort of a premise form. Therefore, you should vote for Dan. Well, there's something missing in that, unless you have a logical link between the premises and the conclusion. So you identify the premises or the claims. You look for the difference between claims that are providing evidence, called premises, and then you look for the conclusion, and then you look for the logical link. Is there a logical link there? In this case, there's a missing logical link, and that is something that we could fill in, and probably the person that sent you that hopes you'll fill it in, or you won't realize that there's something missing in the logic there. But the thing that's missing is, and we could fill this in as a second premise, in this election, you should only vote for a candidate who will cut taxes and create jobs. So we could put that all together. And I know this is going fast and it's on the radio, but we're going to post this on Facebook, into a logical argument. And it becomes a logical deductive argument. And it goes like this. Premise one is, in this election, you should only vote for a candidate who will cut taxes and create jobs. That's the one I filled in. The second premise is, Dan is the only candidate in this election who will cut taxes and create jobs. And the conclusion is, therefore, in this election, you should vote for Dan Gilligan.
That doesn't make a good bumper sticker, though.
It doesn't. But it makes a good argument, right? That's a valid deductive argument. The logic is valid. And you can do a little Venn diagram to prove that, you know, a little diagram these out. And the deductive logical argument is only, even though the logic is valid, is it's only as good as whether the premises are true or not. If the premises are true in a logical deductive argument, then the conclusion has to be true. But if one or more of the premises are not true, then the argument is valid, but it's not sound, and it's therefore not very persuasive, right? Mm-hmm. So you first identify the claims, see if there are premises and a conclusion, see if there's a logical link between the premises and the conclusion, and then if there is, you've got a valid argument, and then you look to see if the premises are true. You'd examine those premises, and there's a couple of them, so how would you know? Let's take that first premise.
Well, I mean, I would have to ask myself. The first premise, you know, as you said, is in this election, you should only vote for the candidate who would cut taxes and create jobs. Well, I have to ask myself, you know, is that the only person I should vote for? Are there other priorities? Are there more important priorities or priorities that should be simply taken into consideration? You know, it's a very simple premise that if I were to ask myself, would not be true for me.
Yeah. And by filling in those missing premises, it puts the microscope under the argument and causes you to think about whether you agree with those premises or not. And the second premise it has to do with really knowing whether Dan is going to vote to cut taxes and create jobs. How do we know that? I mean, he could have promised to do that, but does he have a track record of doing that? So that's kind of forecasting, right? That's trying to tell something in the future that's going to happen. So we got through this. I know it's a lot, and I want to say once again, we're going to post this on our Facebook page, but we're encouraging you. And one of the reasons we're encouraging you is because some of our listeners podcast listeners have encouraged us to get to the nuts and bolts. Mm. We've talked about a lot of topics that impinge on critical thinking, our biases and polarization and all that kinds of stuff, but they're clamoring for some nuts and bolts of how you do that and where you start. So that's what we're trying to give you tonight. We've outlined one little example here, which is a simple example, but when you go to your real life information feed and start examining this, there's going to be a lot of extraneous things in there. But remember, some of that is to motivate you emotionally. What we're looking for is claims, evidence, and conclusions, and a valid logical argument of some sort. We'll talk next time a little bit about the other kind of argument, which is inductive arguments.
And I think another really important reason that we are kind of outlining this, laying out the vetting process, is because, like we've said earlier today and in many shows in the past, it is extra work. It does take practice. If it were so intuitive and easy, you know, then we probably wouldn't have to even need this radio show. So part of that is to have a tool, you know, that you can utilize to practice those system two thinking, if you will. Did I get that right? I always get the numbers mixed up.
Yeah. System one is the intuitive, fast system, and system two is the more deliberative, slower, analytic system. So why don't we open the phone lines, Julia? Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Yeah, I really enjoy your show. I do want to think clearly. But I don't have a computer myself. I don't really feel the need to have one in my life. But there are times when I want somebody to look up something for me. And so times I have friends, you know, most of my friends have computers, my kids have computers. So I was under the impression that Google was something you could ask them just about anything and they would find it out for you. But I had this one situation where I was asking a question from this friend, he was Googling, and they kept coming up with very superficial answers and not really answering what I was really asking. And it was kind of frustrating. It was like, well, this isn't what I'm asking to know. And then another time I was at my son's house, and he has one of those Alexa things where you say, hey, Alexa, you know, what's the weather, or turn on K-Mud for me or something. So I had asked, I want to hear Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks. So they played the album. Alexa played the album, and she talks back to you. And then I said, okay, now I want to hear such and such a song or a different album. And they played one song from the other album. But then they said, oh, well, because of what you have asked us to play for you, we think you might like this song. And they played a complete song that I didn't care about hearing at all, and they wouldn't play the song. I kept asking to hear the other Bob Dylan song, and they wouldn't even play it. So it's like, well, is she at my beck and call? Is she my slave, or am I her slave? I mean, what's going on
here? Well, that's a great question. Would you be willing to, in the first example that you gave, would you be willing to tell us what you were trying to look up, and we might be able to give you some ideas as to what keywords would give you that information?
It's about certain medicines, you know, like how long they stayed in your system and certain mm-hmm. effects that they had. And, they would not say, they just wouldn't give that information.
Julia, how would you, if she wanted to find a certain specific medicine, whatever that is, and find out the, you know, the levels that goes into the bloodstream, how long it takes to peak and that sort of thing, how would you search that?
Yeah, you know, searching is kind of like a language in and of itself, and it really does take practice to kind of learn like what keywords are going to get you what you want. Another thing I like to draw people's attention to, the fancy term for it is a Boolean search, but basically that's just using and, or not. And I find using the and, or if you're in Google, that would be the plus sign, is very, very helpful. So if you want to find venomous snakes in Virginia, I keep coming back to that, you'll want to make sure that you have a plus sign on Virginia and a plus sign on venomous. So to make sure that those are always included in your search results. And also just exploring, searching, you know, it's very common that you don't get what you're looking for the first time, but sort of exploring what those results are, maybe picking up other keywords related to that search that you can also utilize.
Well, I liked your example with the snakes, and you said about the frogs. So you got all the snake information. Then you wanted to know about frogs, and they wouldn't send you frog information. They sent you more snake information. How would you be able to, you know, tell them, no, enough about snakes already. I want to hear about frogs.
Yeah, so I would put frog in quotes to make sure that it's exactly that. Or if I were doing something like herpetology is the study of reptiles and amphibians. So I would, you know, maybe put herpetology plus frog to make sure that you get those results. Or also, like Bob mentioned, DuckDuckGo is the amazing thing about DuckDuckGo search versus Google is Google search is very smart in many ways, but sometimes a little too smart. DuckDuckGo, the good thing there is if Bob were to be searching venomous snakes, Virginia, you were to be searching venomous snakes, Virginia, I were to be searching venomous snakes, Virginia, we would get the exact same results on DuckDuckGo. That is not the case for Google.
Oh, how strange.
Yeah, and of course.
So they want you to know what they want you to know, what not what you're asking to want to know.
In a way, it's actually, they're trying to give you what they think you want.
Yeah.
Well, how about what I'm asking for? I think that's what I want.
Well, like Julia says, it takes a little practice to actually get the keywords down.
Oh.
I've done a lot. It took me a long time to get to the point where I'm pretty good now about doing a search, whether I'm using Google or DuckDuckGo. I usually use Google, and getting what I want. I find that quotes are very helpful because if you put it in quotes, they're not going to break the word up. Or look for synonyms or other information.
It sounds like a chess game, you know?
It sounds like what?
Like a chess game that you have to play with them.
It's a different kind of language, I would say. It's a different way of, it's a different lingo, if you will.
And yeah, but it sounds like you have to know the rules to say the special thing to get what you want, or else they'll get you. They won't give you what you want. They'll give you what they want. Because you might buy a certain product that they're pushing. It sounds like this game of who's smarter than who, you know, who can...
Now, I would actually say it's like, remember like the old card system in libraries. If you go into a library and you're like, I'm trying to find a book about snakes. How does anyone make any sense? What does that have to do with 200.16? So it's a matter of understanding the system. And it's not even necessary. I mean, selling you something is definitely a factor, but it's not always about selling you something.
Oh, okay.
It's literally just trying to cater to what... the history says your preferences are. And the other thing I want to throw out there is Wikipedia. You know, I know if I'm ever looking for like some factual information about like a medication or a snake or any of those things, I just skip Google. I go straight to Wikipedia.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Keep practicing with your friends' computers, and you'll get better and better because there is a wonderfully abundant amount of information. I am always impressed by what I can find out on the internet.
Yeah, I guess I don't have one myself because I don't want to get sucked into it and get addicted to it, and that's all I ever do.
Yeah.
Because I see that happening a lot, and I'm too old for that.
But you can make it work for you.
I don't have that much time left in the world. I want to do other things.
You can make it work for you and not work against you. And I advocate very strongly for doing that. I'm on Facebook, but I use Facebook for what I want to use it for and not what Zuckerberg wants me to use it for.
Well, that's what you think.
Well, and I don't use it enough to warrant paying for it. Having it in my home, dealing with the electromagnetic frequencies and all of that. I'm pretty sensitive. So I just think I do better not having one myself. And if I need to look something up, I've got a whole bunch of people around me that have.
All right.
That have it.
People are a great resource, too.
All right. Thank you for the show. Bye-bye.
Thank you for calling. So I don't think we have any other callers on the line, and we're getting pretty close to the end of the show here on Thinking Clearly on this episode. But I do want to say that what we're encouraging you to do by going through everything that we're going through on this episode is to start practicing this method. Start at any point you want. You could just start at the first part, the introspection of what your motivations, your biases are, and your goals for information, and leave it at that. But try to put it in play. And then once you learn this method, then you can adapt it to your own style. What makes sense to you, be able to do in the time that you have to vet this information. And the flow is kind of like I said before, there's a logic to it. There's critical introspection in the first part, information literacy in the second part, and then identifying claims and arguments in the third part. Anything quickly, Julia?
Still thinking about the internet like a library. And I kind of wish it had the card system that it had back in the day. It would make the internet a lot easier.
Yeah. Every time you say library and cards, I think of Ghostbusters.
I can't help it.
That's quite a scene. Well, we've used the word truth many times in this episode of Thinking Clearly. And in the next episode, with the help of our guest, we're going to examine the nature of truth. And then in November, we'll discuss what we found using this process in that Dr. Myers video. So now we want to thank our engineer, Dennis. Thank you very much. Great job. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly. Think for yourself.